Matthew 8, verses 1 to 22. Matthew 8, verses 1 to 22. When Jesus came down from the hill, large crowds followed him. Then a man suffering from a dreaded skin disease came to him, knelt down before him and said, "Sir, if you want to, you can make me clean." Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him. "I do want to," he answered. "Be clean." At once the man was healed of his disease. Then Jesus said to him, "Listen, don't tell anyone, but go straight to the priest and let him examine you. Then in order to prove to everyone you are cured, offer the sacrifice that Moses ordered." When Jesus entered Capernaum, a Roman officer met him and begged him for help. "Sir, my servant is sick in bed at home, unable to move and suffering terribly." "I will go and make him well," Jesus said. "Oh no, sir," answered the officer. "I do not deserve to have you come into my house. Just give the order and my servant will get well. I too am a man under the authority of superior officers and I have soldiers under me. I order this one, go, and he goes, and I order that one, come, and he comes. I order my slave, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he was surprised and said to the people following him, "I tell you, I have never found anyone in Israel with faith like this. I assure you that many will come from the east and from the west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob at the feast of the kingdom of heaven. But those who should be in the kingdom will be thrown out into darkness, where they will cry and grind their teeth." Then Jesus said to the officer, "Go home, and what you believe will be done for you." And the officer's servant was healed that very moment. Jesus went to Peter's home, and there he saw Peter's mother-in-law sick in bed with a fever. He touched her hand. The fever left her, and she got up and began to wait on him. When evening came, people brought to Jesus many who had demons in them. Jesus drove out the evil spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. He did this to make what the prophet Isaiah had said come true. "He himself took our sickness and carried away our diseases." When Jesus noticed the crowd around him, he ordered the disciples to go to the other side of the lake. A teacher of the law came to him. "Teacher," he said, "I am ready to go with you wherever you go." Jesus answered him, "Foxes have holes and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lie down and rest." Another man who was a disciple said, "Sir, first let me go back and bury my father." "Follow me," Jesus answered, "and let the dead bury their own dead."
I promise you strong and stable leadership. It's not what I promise you this morning, though I do hope I don't falter too much as I speak, but that was the soundbite of Theresa May's tenure as Prime Minister. She said it over and over again, strong and stable leadership, a promise of authority to deliver Brexit and to unite an ununited kingdom. But as we know, she was unable to demonstrate that authority. Her discussions with the EU went south. She had a record defeat in Parliament over her deal, and this week she announced her resignation after being pushed out by her MPs. She couldn't demonstrate her authority, and as a result, people didn't want to follow her. They rejected her authority. I'm sure you can think of similar experiences you've had with authority where you've had to either submit or reject it. Think of laws we probably obey all the time, red lights and speed limits. Maybe they're authority you reject. Or think of positions of authority you've held with people following you or rejecting your authority. Parents have an authoritative position with children, don't they? As an expectant father myself, I anticipate the children always do exactly what they're told. But unlike Theresa May or our parental responsibilities, in our passage today we're going to see an unrivaled authority, one that asks for a response. And we're starting, as Andy said, a new series in Matthew, picking up at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, which is actually what lasers are looking at now. So it's good that they're here. They should be experts on it in a couple of weeks' time. So if you don't remember those sermons from a couple of years ago, ask them. And at the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has been teaching great truths. And as we come into chapter 8, we start to see Jesus do some great things. And in this passage, we're going to pick up on some major themes that run through it, three in particular. We don't have time to look at everything, but three major themes we're going to look at. And the first one, as we've just been thinking about, is the authority of Jesus. The authority of Jesus. That's introduced at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Just glance over at the end of chapter 27, verses 28 and 29. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching because he spoke as one who had authority, not as their teachers of the law. We're already introduced to the idea of Jesus having authority, and as we lead from this incredible sermon where Jesus demonstrates his authority through words, we come into chapter 8 where Jesus demonstrates his authority through works. In our passage today, this authority is demonstrated in the act of healing. In verse 16, we're told that Jesus healed all who were ill that were brought to him. So Jesus healing people isn't a rare occurrence. It's not something that happens occasionally. In fact, it's how Jesus began his ministry. In chapter 4, we're told he went around healing every disease and illness among the people. But in chapter 8, we have these three healings that are given special prominence, that they have more details. So clearly Matthew thought there was something worth highlighting. And as we look at Jesus' authority, we're going to focus on his encounter with the leper. Jesus has come down from the mountain, and the leper approaches him, kneels before him, and sees Jesus' status, saying, verse 2, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." The leper has no doubt over Jesus' ability to heal him. "You can make me clean. I know you can do it if you are willing." He recognizes Jesus has authority over his disease, and that all Jesus needs to do is will for it to happen, and he'll be healed. And Jesus' response, I think, is surprising. Have a look at verse 3. He touches the man, says, "I am willing," and commands, "Be clean." Now, it may not seem surprising to us who know these kind of healing stories, but lepers were considered not only infectious from a medical point of view, but they were also unclean spiritually and ceremonially. They were complete outcasts from Jewish society and even the temple. To touch a leper was to catch their uncleanliness, as well as risk infection from their disease. If you don't know leprosy, it's a really horrible illness. It devastates the skin, it causes it to boil, and can cause parts like fingers and toes and noses even to fall off. If you saw someone with an infectious disease like that, would you touch them? But it wasn't the leper's uncleanliness that was contagious, but Jesus' purity. Have a look at the end of verse 3. Immediately, he was cured of his leprosy. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't know of any cures or treatments that are instantaneous and 100% effective. With all our research and studies and experience treating illness, even our most effective treatments are only ever fighting illness, pushing back on symptoms and trying to remove the cause. But not Jesus. Jesus doesn't have to diagnose and analyze the illness to come up with a treatment plan. He just tells it to leave. Could you imagine a doctor that would have that authority? But that's the authority Jesus has over sickness. And interestingly, what does Jesus instruct the leper to do now he's been healed and made clean? Have a look with me at verse 4. Then Jesus said to him, "See that you don't tell anyone, but go and show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them." Now that gift, you may not be aware of it, it's outlined in Leviticus 13. It's the routines someone would have to follow when they were clean of a skin disease. That gift would be a way of the priest confirming that they were now clean and able to come back into society again, back into God's people, back to the temple, where they could engage in religious ceremonies and with God again. And Jesus says that would be a testimony of them, for them, of Jesus' authority over sickness. He says that even though he says, "Don't tell anyone," it might seem contradictory, but it's reminding us and the leper of the dangers of attracting enthusiasm for the wrong reasons. Jesus, he's not just a magic healer. He's a promised Messiah that reconciles people to God. And it's not just in the healing of the leper that we see Jesus' authority over sickness. We see it twice more throughout this passage that we've just had read. With the centurion's servant, he doesn't even see the person he's healing. He just says, "Go, let it be done," verse 13. And at that moment, the servant was healed. It's not just a verbal command either that Jesus needs to say and someone will be healed. He goes to Peter's mother-in-law, and with just a touch, she goes from a bedridden lady to jumping up and serving him. Now, the lesson here is not that when we encounter Jesus, we should make more tea and coffee, though that is a good thing. But it demonstrates Jesus' authority to completely annihilate sickness, to completely change someone. Peter's mother-in-law goes from bedridden to physically waiting on Jesus. Jesus has an authority to heal with a touch, with words, or with both. It's not like a magician who needs to follow the steps perfectly to maintain an illusion. No, Jesus has authority to drive out sickness, not by what he does, but by who he is, which is what we come to after these healings. Matthew tells us in verse 17, have a look, that these healings were to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and carried our diseases. That's a passage from Isaiah 53, where we're given a picture of God's suffering and glorified servant. It's a picture that we see fulfilled over and over again in Jesus, particularly Jesus going to the cross, suffering in our place, bearing our pain and our sin. These healings are a glimpse of the bigger picture that's being painted in Isaiah 53, a glimpse of the kingdom of heaven won through the death and resurrection of Jesus. At the cross is where we see this Isaiah passage fulfilled completely, when Jesus puts to death our sickness and our sin and our suffering. Of course, we still see these things today. We still know sickness and suffering and sin. But this passage is glimpsing the kingdom of heaven. It's like a window. We're not in it, but we can see some of it. A kingdom without sickness and suffering because Jesus has eradicated it. A kingdom where we're reconciled to God. A kingdom where all are welcomed, as we'll see shortly. And a kingdom where we're no longer dirty from sin, but made clean by faith in Jesus. We don't see that kingdom fully realized right now, which is why we still have sickness and suffering. But one day we won't, when Jesus returns. So we can and should still pray for healing because Jesus' authority hasn't changed. But we should also be cautious not to necessarily expect healing because we're not in that kingdom yet. God is healer and can heal, but he's already dealt with sickness and sin once for all through Jesus on the cross. Now that to me is the most glorious and amazing thing, a great reassurance. We see an amazing Jesus, an authoritative Jesus who gives us a glimpse of heaven. And how are we going to respond to that? Well, let's have a look at Jesus' encounter with the centurion, which will help us. This is the second thing we see. We see the authority of Jesus, and now we see the faith of the centurion. Jesus comes into Capernaum, a fishing village. It's likely home to several of the disciples. And a centurion comes and asks Jesus for help. In verse 6, he says, Lord, my servant lies at home paralyzed and in terrible suffering. To which Jesus responds, I will go and heal him. The centurion outlines his problem and Jesus offers to help. It seems straightforward. We've seen Jesus has authority to heal sickness. He just has to do it and it will be done. But what stands out here is the centurion's response to Jesus. It's a response that we're told astonishes Jesus in verse 10. So what does the centurion say? He says verse 8 and 9, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. The centurion not only humbles himself before Jesus, saying he's not worthy to have him in his house, but he speaks about his position in the Roman army. It seems like an odd conversation topic here. But you see, a centurion was in charge of 100 Roman soldiers. He commanded them, and when he commanded them, he didn't do it under his own authority, but under the authority of the Roman Empire, which is something he's saying he recognizes in Jesus. Not that Jesus commands Roman soldiers, but that Jesus has an authority over sickness because he's under authority from above, from the Father. In the same way that when the centurion speaks, he speaks with the full backing of Rome, the source of his authority. When Jesus speaks, he speaks with the full backing of the kingdom of heaven, the source of his authority. So no wonder Jesus is amazed at this response. This Gentile soldier, a commander from an enemy occupying force, recognizes who Jesus is as someone sent from God and under authority of heaven. And in recognizing Jesus for who he is, he puts his faith in Jesus to heal his servant. Just say the word and he'll be healed. The soldier shows his faith by trusting Jesus. Just as we show faith in the pews we're sitting on today, we know they'll hold our weight. We believe they'll hold our weight, but we're only demonstrating that belief, that faith, when we actually sit on the pew. That's what the soldier does here. He doesn't need to see Jesus heal his servant. He doesn't need that evidence. He just trusts in him. He says, say the word, and it'll be done. Which is, of course, what happens in verse 13. The servant was healed at that very hour. And, of course, the centurion won't see that until he gets home. But he's seen Jesus' authority. He's seen where it comes from. And he responds to it by trusting Jesus. What makes it potentially more amazing is the contrast with the people of Israel. Verse 10, Jesus says, truly, I tell you the truth, I've not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. He's not found anyone in all of God's chosen people who has this faith in him. It's pretty amazing that out of anyone who could recognize Jesus for who he is, the person who does is an outsider, someone from a different class and culture, which is a point Jesus drives home in verses 11 and 12. He says, I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness, where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's a pretty scary picture at the end there. Particularly for the Jewish people. The Jewish people were considered God's chosen people. The people of Israel were those God had selected to be his people. But Jesus is saying that people will come from the east and the west, nations other than Israel, and they'll be sat at the feast with the kingdom of heaven, while the subjects of the kingdom of heaven, the people of Israel, will be thrown out into darkness with weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's not a nice picture for the Israelites. But why? Because those people from other nations are responding to who Jesus is. They're placing their trust in him. In contrast, those who think they're safe and aren't trusting Jesus, well, it says here they're cast out because they didn't. Imagine if you had a rich, distant aunt. She owns land, mansions, horses, cars, the whole lot. You know her, you know of her, you know about her, but you've never really made any sort of attempt at a relationship with her. And then one day, you hear she's passed away, and you're her only living relative. Jackpot, you might think, if you're a cynic like me. You might be pretty excited. She's no one else to leave all this to. And when you get to the will reading, you find that actually it's been left to a load of other people, friends, neighbors, people that did have a relationship with her, that knew her and cared about her, turned to her for support, loved her, and she loved them in return. When we think of it like that, it would seem silly that we'd think we'd have a right to that inheritance just because of who we were, because we were someone that was family, was blood. Just because of who we are, we don't have a claim on that inheritance. But that's what the Israelites were thinking here, the people that Jesus is speaking about. Lots of them think they're safe, that they'll inherit the kingdom because of who they are as people of Israel. But that's not the case because they're not turning to Jesus while other people are. And it's a stark reminder for us today, an encouragement for outsiders who maybe don't know God, but also a warning to insiders. Jesus welcomes anyone, he's saying. Whether you've been at church since you were born or whether this is your very first time here, Jesus welcomes anyone. It's something we see in the three healings. We see the leper, an outcast of Jewish society, the centurion, a Gentile, the polar opposite of a Jew, and a woman, a second-class citizen. Jewish culture didn't accept women. Jesus welcomes anyone. Anyone who puts their faith and trust in him will have a place at that feast in heaven. Isn't that a glorious image? But it's also a reminder to us who think we're safe because we trust in Jesus. But do we have the same confidence in Jesus that the centurion and the leper do? They accept that they're weak, that they need Jesus because he's strong. They look to him and trust him. They see who he is, his authority, and they put their faith in him. Maybe we feel like we don't always do that. I know I don't. Maybe we want to. We start to feel safe and get complacent. We start to think we can get by on our own, solve our own problems, overcome our own temptations, that we don't need Jesus because that would mean admitting we're weak, which is something we really don't want to do. We try to build ourselves up to seem strong rather than look to him who is already strong, Jesus. He wants us to see his authority and respond by placing our trust in him. And what we see here is that seems like the natural response to experiencing him. We've seen an amazing, authoritative Jesus, seeing who he is, what he can do, and glimpsed the kingdom that is to come. It's not hugely surprising that people wanted to follow him, which is what happens at the end of this passage. People start flocking to him. They're eager to follow him. And that's what we see. The final thing we're going to think about today is the cost of following. The cost of following. Jesus sees the crowd that's now flocking to him in verse 18, and he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake. And then people come up to Jesus. The first man in verse 19, a teacher of the law, comes to him and says this, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus doesn't exactly encourage him or stop him. He says, "Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." It's an odd response. It might not be the same response we'd give if someone asked if they could come with us somewhere. But Jesus is making a point in not affirming or rejecting the man's intention. He's not saying that you can't follow me, but he's not saying you should. He's just saying that there is a cost to following me. There's something you need to be aware of. It's like when we book holidays, we might go to gov.uk and check if there's anything we need to be aware of the country we're visiting, because it gives us safety warnings, terrorism risks, and that sort of thing. It doesn't say don't go here because it's dangerous. It says here's some things you might want to know before you commit to going. That's what Jesus is doing. He's saying you can come with me, but here's what you need to understand. Foxes and birds will have more certain homes than you. You won't be in control of where you live. You're just going to have to let go of your control. And the warning is clear in that response. If you can't deal with that, then you're not ready to follow me wherever I'll go. Following me is going to be difficult. And I wonder if we ever think about that. Are we aware that following Jesus fully may mean giving up control over our lives? That control we so desperately crave, or I know I certainly do. Maybe you're aware of the cost, the difficulties of facing Jesus, but you think, no, it's okay, that's going to come later. That's not for me right now. The hard bit, I'll come to that later. But that's a little bit like the second man who comes to Jesus. He comes to Jesus in verse 21 and says, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." He says, "I'm willing to follow you, Jesus. I'm aware of the cost that it's going to take. And I will follow you, but once my father's in the ground, and I don't need to worry about him anymore." But then verse 22, Jesus says to him, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." It's almost a command. Follow me and leave them to it. The disciple can choose whether he wants to submit to that command or reject it. But Jesus is saying, "I'm more important than your family. Leave them behind." That would be a pretty daunting cost. You can see why the disciple might want to put off following Jesus, make an excuse for why not yet, because he loves his family. He says, "I will follow you, but first I just need to bury my father. I will follow you, but first I just need to." I wonder how familiar that sentence sounds to you. I will follow you, but first I just need to. Is that something you do often? Maybe it's a case of following Jesus completely. I will follow you, Jesus, but first I just want to finish my degree. I just want to get the right job. I just want to marry the right person. Maybe it's smaller steps. I will read my Bible, Jesus. I will get to know you, but first I just need to finish the washing up. Just need to go to work. Just need to make my breakfast. I will sit and pray, but first I just need to have a shop done for the week. We do it all the time. I certainly do it all the time. We see this amazing, authoritative Jesus who gives us a glimpse of the kingdom of heaven, and we put him after our shopping instead of first in everything. I wonder what it is that stops you, what you'd find difficult to sacrifice, what you find distracting. Maybe it's your job or your family. They make you complacent in your relationship with Jesus. Not that they're wrong things, but they often find their ways to becoming wrong priorities. I want to be clear, Jesus isn't saying become homeless and miss all the family funerals and give up your family. But he's saying give your life to me. Give up control and turn to me. It might mean turning our backs on something we know is not productive for our walk with Christ. And that might be hard, but let me ask you, whether this is the first time you've heard this or whether you've heard it 100 times, those glimpses we see of the kingdom of heaven, an eternal kingdom without sickness, sin, suffering, with God, all together, do we weigh that correctly against the things that we might have to sacrifice, against the difficulties we may face? Do we live like it's true, like there's this amazing reward, a crown of glory at the end, but we have to carry a daily cross? Isn't that reward worth anything? What appears now to be an overwhelming amount of sickness and suffering, pain and hardship, that pales next to the glory of the kingdom. It might mean changing our routine so that we can get Jesus into our day easier, getting up earlier, or putting something else off. But what Jesus is saying here is he wants us to follow him wholeheartedly, knowing that it'll be difficult, and sacrificing that which stops us. And as a result, we will be with him for eternity with no more pain and no more suffering. That's the response he asks for. Let's take a moment of quiet, and then I'll close us in prayer.